Welcome to NC Valor, hosted by Dr. Alan Marshall. NC Valor honors our North Carolina veterans by sharing with you their stories of courage, bravery, and valor. NC Valor is proudly sponsored by Green Dreams Landscape Management, where dreams are grown. Whatever your dreams, our team at Green Dreams will work with you to make them a reality. Now here's your host, Dr. Alan Marshall.
Welcome to NC Valor, a radio show that brings you the valor of North Carolina through its veterans and their stories. I'm Dr. Alan Marshall, and I'm the head of school at Sandhills Classical Christian School in Southern Pines. I want to thank Green Dreams Landscape Management for sponsoring NC Valor and making this show possible. Today, we have a special guest that's visiting with us today. We have Jason Houck. He's an Army veteran, and he's a Middle East and Islam specialist. So I just want to welcome you here today, Jason, and thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Jason, we usually start off with where you were born and where you grew up.
So I was born in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, just outside of Canada. And then I moved to Florida when I was 10 and went through high school there.
I think you grew up right there near the Kennedy Space Center. Is that right?
Yeah. We were just a short – we got to watch all the shuttle launches in the 80s and great place to grow up between the beach and the swamp. So fishing, surfing, skateboarding.
Yeah, it sounds like a fun young life there. Now, you went to high school there, and then after you graduated, you knew you were going into the Army. I think you joined in 1991. Is that right?
That's right. My senior year, I had already been enlisted in a delayed entry program. So I'd signed up to be a paratrooper at the 82nd in the infantry. And in 91, I got done and went off to basic.
Yeah, now, as far as getting in the Army, I think you had a mentor that kind of really influenced you. Can you tell me about that?
I did. I had two folks. One, Mr. Cole, was an Army veteran, and he talked to me about staying in high school and getting my degree and going off in the Army and what I could learn and how I could use that in my life.
Because you weren't really interested in staying in high school, right?
No, I was hoping to drop out and go to work, and I had a couple smart veterans, both Vietnam-era guys. The other one was Lamar Cox, who was ended up being a good friend and a mentor still today, and he was a Marine Corps Force Recon vet, and he talked to me about becoming a paratrooper and joining the infantry, and it sounded like a good plan, so I'm glad he gave me advice.
Yeah, that's good, because we often hear with our veterans coming in here, they'll often mention that one special person or one or two that really influenced their life and put them on a whole different path, and a lot of times they're veterans that were mentors to them.
Yeah, I believe that happens a lot.
Yeah, so you went to Fort Benning for your initial training, but then you went to Fort Bragg, and I think you joined a Pathfinder company, is that right?
Yeah, I spent 3 years in an infantry company in the 504th, and then I went to spend a year with a Pathfinder company, and back to the 504th,
okay.
And then I made sergeant within that 5 years, and then thought about becoming an officer.
Okay, and I think you were part of the Green to Gold program. Can you explain that?
So I had zero college, so I needed all 4 years, and the Green to Gold had a four-year scholarship program. So I signed up for that, got selected, and went off to Alabama to go to college.
And I think you ended up graduating from Auburn through the ROTC program?
I did. I started at Tuskegee University my freshman year, and I transferred up the road 20 miles to Auburn and graduated there in 2000 as an engineer officer.
Okay, so we start off as a lieutenant engineer. And now we're going to talk about this transition that made you a Middle East and Islam specialist.
So I went back to Fort Bragg, luckily. I got my first choice. Was a combat engineer in the 307th and the 618th. And then Afghanistan deployment loomed right after September 11th. So I went over there, spent time with the 82nd building the forward operating base and the airfield called Salerno down by the Pakistan border. And then I extended my tour to a year instead of the 6 months and was sent to Kabul, the capital, to help Major General Eikenberry to build the Afghan army and to help the Afghan government to set themselves up. So, and he was a foreign area officer, and he kind of taught me the ropes on how all that works.
Yeah, so he was a former area officer, and of course he was general in command there, but you served as an aide-de-camp for him, right?
Right. I was his aide-de-camp, and we did that for a year together. Learned a lot and got to see. He was a China specialist, but as a foreign area officer, he understood, you know, how embassies worked, how the UN worked, how all this policy level stuff actually happens. And so he took a lot of time to mentor me during that year. It was really useful.
That's a great opportunity because, you know, you were seeing a lot of high level strategy and planning and then just the politics that goes with it.
Yeah, definitely. It was insightful, and just working with the Afghan government every day, got to see how that works, even at a level at the U.S. government or at another country's government.
Okay. And then when you, I think you came back and had a joint tour.
Yeah, I came back.
As a company commander?
Did my company command time as an engineer officer and was stationed at an Air Force base in Texas. Worked with the Air Force and the Navy as with construction engineer units. So I got to see the construction side of things and worked in a joint environment there. Then I applied at that point to become a foreign area officer because that's the time period you get to ask for a new job.
And that's becoming a foreign area officer is a pretty, you know, there's a lot of competition for that. I think you got a letter from someone who helped you out. Who was that?
Yeah, I had General Eikenberry sent a letter in, and I think General McChrystal did as well, who had been my battalion commander when I was a young infantryman. And so they helped push me into that, and I went into the Arabic Middle East program to become a foreign area officer.
Yeah, I think, letters from General Eikenberry and General McChrystal are probably pretty helpful getting you into that program.
I imagine they were. They taught me a lot. So
that's great. Now, you went from there. You did your foreign area officer training, and then you went to Naval Postgraduate School?
Yeah. First step on my training was to get my master's degree in the Middle East and South Asia. So I went to Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey.
That's pretty tough work right there, huh?
That was a good load. A great place to live, but a tough load. That yeah. Really demanding professors, but it was great. I learned a lot and really started to focus studying more about Islam and made that part of my thesis to look at parts of the religion as well.
And then afterwards, you did language training?
Yeah, right afterwards, I moved over to the Arabic language school up on the hill at DLI, and I was there until had about 6 months of Arabic training. And then that got interrupted.
Yeah, I think you got a call from the Army. I think it may have been even through General McChrystal to go to Afghanistan.
Yeah, he was putting a new staff together, and he was looking for people who knew about Afghanistan and had a history with it. So we packed up our stuff. I dropped my wife in Pinehurst, and I went to the Pentagon, and then we flew to Afghanistan within a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty rapid deployment, and we hit the ground to do the strategy review for NATO in America on what we were going to do differently in Afghanistan.
And again, that's another front row seat to a lot of history and a lot of really important things going on.
Yeah, definitely. Really insightful to see. It was a new administration coming in after the Bush administration, so just to see how they functioned and operated and to see how the Afghan government would work with a guy like General McChrystal and then Ambassador Eikenberry, who was back in Kabul, to make a new plan and come up with a new idea.
Okay. Once you came back from that, I think that was in the 2009, 2010 time frame, you came back and then you did some more language training.
Yeah, I finished up that year in Afghanistan. I helped a guy named Sir Lam, who had been General Petraeus' deputy in Iraq, to set up a peace process with the Afghan government. And then I came back and they had to finish my language school. I was still finishing the FAO training. So I went back and studied Dari or Farsi, which is spoken in Afghanistan and Iran mostly. And that was spent a year back at Monterey. Not a bad place to be when you come back from a combat tour.
Absolutely. Now, that name, Sir Lam, working with General Petraeus, if any of you veterans out there were in Iraq and you'd hear General Petraeus talking, you know, he'd have, Sir, go do this, go do that, go check that. So he got around.
Definitely. That guy worked in many places.
Yeah. So General Petraeus used him a lot for a lot of things. And it's just interesting. You hear him, your story about him being in Afghanistan doing the same thing. Now, I think then you went to joint staff. Is that right?
Yeah. After I finished that language course, went out to back to the Pentagon and worked on the joint staff for 2 or 3 years. Again, keep an eye on Afghanistan and Pakistan and working with different policymakers in D.C.
Okay. And then what did you do after that joint staff tour?
Finished up a couple special projects with the joint staff, and then I put in my retirement paperwork. Was going to go back to Pinehurst and go fishing,
but it didn't work out that way, really, right?
No, my wife tells me I'm really bad at retiring, so I came back and got pulled into some public speaking events. Probably pushed and pulled into there, but started talking about Afghanistan, and all the questions were about Islam. So I unpacked Islam for the community and started traveling around the state and the East Coast talking about Islam and ISIS and groups like that, and trying to help people understand what's going on in the Middle East.
Okay. And I think you even do some teaching, right?
Yes. After doing some public speaking, Dr. Dempsey asked me to come over to Sandhills and start a couple of courses there. So I started last fall. I teach Introduction to the Modern Middle East and also an Introduction to Islam course.
Okay. And that's I want to point out that your operational experience and being out there and, you know, that real-world training, I mean, that's pretty good to have a professor that actually has been there and done that.
I think it helps me, and that's what I get the feedback from the students. I'm putting it into, you know, simple language that Americans can understand without having, you know, been overseas. But I have both a scholar's view and a soldier's view of what's going on overseas, and it also at the political level and the international level. I got to see all the different pieces of the puzzle, so I can put that together in a class.
Yeah, and so when you cover a lot of the, you know, the things that are being written about that period of time, I mean, you have some front row seat experience to that.
Yeah, definitely got to watch a lot of senior leaders go through a lot of painful events and see the good and bad.
Okay, and I think you also teach for the DOD in some certain capacities.
Yeah, I do a little bit of teaching for the Joint Special Ops University and one of the intelligence community courses. So I try to stay busy, not too often, but teach now and go when I'm not speaking or writing.
Okay. And in your free time, you're working on a book. Just tell me about your book you're writing.
For the last year, a little over a year now, I've been translating the Quran into modern English, putting it in a chronological sequence so you can actually understand it in a quick read. And that was the goal. As I spoke about Islam for the last year and in my courses, I realized that people just have no understanding of it. And when they try to read any of the versions that are out there in English, it's so convoluted. The grammar is bad. The English is old. You know, there's archaic words that are out of English usage that are still in there. It's like a bad Shakespeare novel that's a play that's out of order. So mm-hmm. I'm putting it back in order and putting it in simple English so that people can read it quickly.
Yeah, and that's pretty useful. If you've ever looked at the Quran, it is very confusing, and it not being in chronological order, and then just some of the English, you know, Arabic to English translation is very tough. So I can see that it would be very helpful for foreign area officers. It would be helpful for anybody in the military having to deal with this culture or anything like that.
That's what I kind of kept in mind when I was doing this. I have a lot of military friends that are ready to get a copy of this and help them to understand it and read it quickly. And I leaned on all the professors I had and Islamic scholars that I've worked with over the years to take a look at what I'm doing and make sure it's in keeping with what the Quran actually says in Arabic. So trying to get it right, but keep it simple. Never going to be perfect, but I hope this is a useful tool for people.
Yeah, it sounds like a very useful tool. you're listening to NC Valor on Talk 97.3 FM and 990 AM WEEB. We're talking to Jason Hawk. He's an Afghanistan and Islam specialist. We talked earlier, and I called him an expert, and he said, wait a second now. you can study this stuff for decades and not necessarily be the expert, but you're a specialist because you specialize in this.
Yeah, I think that's a better way to look at it. Student of the Middle East and Islam. you'll never master this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I do want to take some time now to kind of leverage your expertise on the Middle East so that we can get kind of for the audience just a lay down of what's happening and who's who and where we are right now. As many folks know, we had 9/11, and then that led to our invasion of Afghanistan, and we took on the Taliban because those were the folks that were harboring the folks that knocked down the towers.
Correct. Yep.
And at least initially, that was a very successful operation.
Yeah, I agree. The small footprint that we sent in there, special operators, CIA, a few conventional forces, did the trick. The Taliban were gone. The regime changed. But we kind of took away one bad lesson from that, as it was a very specific country that had a specific problem set. It had been broken for 25 years. So we were bringing some semblance and order to this country, and the Afghans were hungry for that at the beginning. That doesn't apply to every war and every country, and I think that's one of the things the DOD walked away from Afghanistan thinking.
Yeah, Secretary Rumsfeld, you know, it was kind of a radical thought to go in with such a small footprint and take down the Taliban, and it was successful. So in some ways, it kind of set us up for a mistake in Iraq, I think.
Yeah, I would have to agree. If you look at Desert Storm and how many people we planned on bringing in and how large the coalition was.
500,000 plus.
Yeah, easily on by the invasion date. You know, we went in with, you know, less than 200,000 and a coalition that didn't put as much into the early invasion that came on
We're
later.
We're talking about Iraq now.
For
so
Iraq,
we went to Iraq.
Yeah, 2003. A little bit different mindset. Iraq was a functioning country. They had a dictator, but it was functioning. So when you take down a dictator, you still got to make it function. They had different expectations than the Afghans did, who had no functioning life. You know, it was a broken country, so anything mm-hmm. was better than what they had.
Right.
In Iraq, we didn't plan as well for how do you keep things going in a country that's not
right.
completely broken.
And initially, the actual military combat setup was successful in Iraq.
Yeah, some of the things were textbook. I mean, I talked to a good buddy who rolled into Baghdad with a third ID. They were blown away of how easy it was. It was just like they had thought about doing it. And then we owned it. And then we were in there. We were sitting on top of everything going, what's next?
And this is where kind of that being set up from Afghanistan starts to play out, I think. There were a couple of orders that came down from the civilian leadership that was put in charge in Iraq. And one of them was de-bathification. And then a second one was disbanding the army. So can you explain to us how that kind of set us up even worse?
Yeah, I think that made things even more difficult. And the army was starting to melt away, but when they disbanded the rest of the army, that didn't help matters. You do need a force on the ground to help secure a country that large. And you know, we probably could have weeded through the army and gotten rid of the bad people as we learned more, but we just didn't know anything going in. So we got rid of a security element in an army in a country like that is critical to stability. So we kind of set ourselves up to own all the stability problems with our own forces, which were pretty small compared to the size of the country.
Yeah, and so now we disbanded this army of folks who basically are warriors, and they have weapons, but now they don't have a job and they don't have any way to sustain themselves. So it was we kind of just sowed the seeds of an insurgency.
Sure, that fed the insurgency's recruiting. If somebody wanted to come in and set up an insurgency, you definitely had plenty of able-bodied people to join in.
And then when we did debathification, that's the party. You had to be in the party to be any kind of leadership. So all your scientists, your engineers, your civil leaders were part of this party. So when we said, if you have anything to do with the bath party, you can have no part in the future of Iraq.
Yeah, I think that makes again, compounding the problem. You now own the stability and security, and you're sidelining a bunch of your experts that know how the government did run. And we had some bad advisors helping Bush to figure out what to do, and and that was we made our problem even worse.
But I do want to say here that there were a lot of our military experts and generals were telling them not to do that.
Yeah, I think there were a lot of differing opinions. You know, we had the military saying one thing. Before we even went in, we had our regional allies telling us what not to do, which was not to go in there unless you want to own it. And then once we got there, our regional allies were telling us, you're in there, you own it, you better fix it and don't leave us a mess, which leads to the next problem.
Yeah, so there were some people that kind of knew that what was going to happen, what was happening, wasn't going to work out. And then, sure enough, over a period of a few years, it deteriorated. And then I think this is a place where we can give President Bush some real credit, was the decision for the surge.
Yeah, definitely. In a time when you're an unpopular president in an unpopular war, to change out your SecDef, change out your commander, bring in a guy who, you know, like General Petraeus, who has a plan and listen to him and take it up. And Sir Lam was on the ground at that time in Afghanistan. He was working as Casey's deputy, General Casey, and you know, they were thinking about COIN, but they hadn't ramped it up to the level or changed the bigger strategy to support it, get the rest of the government to support that. And they did it. You know, that was an amazing feat, a Herculean effort to make all that happen. Kudos
and
to those guys.
When you say COIN, the counterinsurgency philosophy or strategy, and of course General Petraeus wrote the manual on that.
Yeah, he was definitely one of the authors. He brought in all the smart folks across the army to look at those lessons and pull them back out and dust them off and use what works. And there were some great ideas in there.
And immediately, I mean, I for anyone who was watching during that period, you could see a difference in what was happening when General Petraeus started applying the counterinsurgency strategy and taking charge of that effort.
Yeah, I think it completely turned around what was happening in Iraq, and the Iraqis felt it too. Mm-hmm. So that led to a pretty good handoff to the next administration.
And then we'll fast forward. The surge worked. I mean, by the time in 2010 time frame, Iraq was in a much better situation. But then we had came to another critical decision where do we stay engaged or do we disengage?
Yeah, and that you know, the Obama administration comes in with a campaign promise to win the good war in Afghanistan and end the bad war in Iraq. And it was tough, I think, for him politically to hear the advice from the Gulf allies that said don't leave in a hurry, and to hear the advice from the military that said don't leave Iraq in a hurry. You know, we need to maintain some leverage. But they went with the Bush model that was in place and went ahead and pulled our troops out, which really set it up for a fall.
Yeah, and again, the experts were saying don't do that, and we did. We pulled out, and sure enough, it pretty much fell apart like everyone who had knew anything and watched did, what said it would do.
Yeah, definitely. We just didn't have anybody advising the military, keeping an eye on it, and it went back to its sectarian ways, pre-surge kind of competition within Iraq, and that set it up for the fall. And the Syrian civil war and ISIS, you know, coming on at the same time, it was too much for Iraq.
Right. So thus now we have, you know, ISIS, which took over northern Iraq and where we are now.
Correct.
So with that said, where do you see us in the Middle East right at this point?
I think we're at a – this is one of those opportunities where you either really make some bold moves and push towards the future, or you keep kind of stumbling along. Our special operators have done a great job in Iraq and in Syria, kind of stemming the tide in a subtle way, and it's working. But they're made – and now we're stuck with what happens to President Assad in Syria. You know, what happens to Russia in the Middle East? Will they give up their foothold and leave? Russians don't usually give up any property. So I don't think they're going to lose their Mediterranean port that they now have. But something's got to happen. We just had that chemical attack yesterday with the Syrian Air Force. So do we make some bold decisions now that are going to help get Assad out of power and hold him accountable, as so many countries are calling for? And do we stay for the long term this time with Iraq and help them to fortify what they've gained and help them finish up in Mosul and push everything out over there? I think we have to make the right choices now, because this is going to set up – this is a generational fight. This ideology that ISIS holds is all over the world in a lot of different countries. And this is one place we can't let it come back. Mm-hmm. These are fragile countries. Syria will take decades to rebuild. So we've got to make the next – batch of hard decisions here. We went back into Iraq and we went into Syria. So, what's next?
Yeah, absolutely. And we do have to win this fight. We cannot let ISIS continue to exist and do the things they're doing.
Yeah, if they continue to pop up in other countries and set up another headquarters and build another, you know, so-called caliphate in another area, we're going to be dealing with the same issue, because that ideology just tears down a country and breaks its fabric.
Yeah, and you mentioned it was a generational issue. We were talking earlier about how, you know, a lot of our generals that were deployed over there were deployed over there for years, 3 to 5 years. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the overlooked things, and maybe historians will look back at this. If we had asked our World War II generals or World War I generals to do what we've asked these generals to do, I think you would have seen a lot of personal failures in World War II. And it's a tough spot. I watched a lot of these generals from 2001 until 2017, and as an aide de camp, you get to know them pretty well and see what they're going through. This was tough. They didn't make a lot of bad strategic decisions or operational decisions or even tactical errors on their front, but a lot of personal decisions that were bad. And I think a lot of that has to do with the pressure of putting somebody in a combat zone for 5 years without their family. And it's a different type of pressure than an infantryman who spends a year on the ground, goes home for 3 years, and comes back. These generals go back to a horrible job when they come out of the combat
zone. Pentagon.
Yeah, they end up at the Pentagon or the CENTCOM or the Joint Staff, and they're getting crushed again. No family time even when they are home, and then go right back into combat. And we seem to have used the same generals over and over again, as mm-hmm. if our military is not capable of producing other great generals to spell them and give them a break. So it led to a lot of personal failures, and that was a tough thing to see for a lot of these soldiers who followed these generals in combat, to watch them fall from grace for personal reasons, just because it was probably a little too much on them.
Right, and this is, 24/7 news. They're on the news every night. They're losing young soldiers, and they're having to send those letters home every night. So the 24/7 stress of combat for years, that's something we need to rethink about how we submit or put people in that position.
I think so. As we look to take care of our younger veterans and our mid-career NCOs who'd spent, 5 or 6 years over 15 period, we also got to keep in mind those senior leaders at the colonel and general and admiral level that did a lot of the same thing with even more stress and pressure, and what that did to them. Everybody needs to be taken care of in the military.
Right, and I think, MacArthur, he went to Japan and he took his wife, and, it was a different model kind of to deal with this. And I know you said General Eikenberry took his wife when he became ambassador.
Yeah, sure did. I got to see the kind of a shift, a way out of that. And Ambassador Eikenberry brought his wife over. He knew he was coming for a 2-year tour as ambassador, and that helped. That changed the way he operated. It gave him some semblance of normalcy. That was his third. That was going to be his four years in Afghanistan, which is not an ideal location for any human being to live.
Right.
And that makes a difference. I think there's some way you can figure out to take care of the senior leaders so they can be more effective longer.
Absolutely. I think it's something we need to think about. It's on both ends of this scale. And you mentioned the generational war. If we are going to be successful in this type of war, this is a 50-year kind of war.
I think it is. We have to really understand the ideologies that our enemy uses and get to understand everything about the culture that those people live in and how they operate, and think long-term, make long-term decisions, and get all foreign policy thinkers and decision-makers to understand we have to be together on this and make those long-term commitments.
Yeah, we also have to, for our lower-level troops, make sure that they're trained properly. We're sending the same people into combat over and over. So we probably need more units to do this role, and then we have to consider their language training and their arms training, all these different trainings. So we need more to be able to do this on a long-term basis.
Without a doubt. Maybe a time for some bold moves in the Army. Scrap one of the infantry divisions and stand up 2 more SF groups and some other special mission units, and build the units that are redeploying so that we can have a bench and just make that part of the plan. This is a long-term way of fighting. We've got to adjust the military to it.
Yeah, so maybe we don't have to send the same folks 9 times. We can have 2 more options, and we can send someone 4 times into a combat zone.
Exactly. Give those guys a break, and we can focus on this. This is an easy thing.
Sure. Well, I really enjoy this discussion. I wish we had more time, because you've got a lot of wealth of knowledge, so I want to invite you back in the future, because I think there's a lot we still haven't got, we haven't picked out of your brain. But I want to thank you first for your service to the country, and thank you for coming and speaking to us today.
Thanks. It was my privilege to serve.
Well, thank you very much today, and just want to thank all those veterans out there that served during this period of time in Iraq and Afghanistan, and hopefully this has been an interesting discussion for you. This has been NC Valor, a show that brings you veterans and their stories from North Carolina.